installments in this program. Who am I? What was it like eating lunch with this tension between the story and no one? You forgot to do it. How many forgot to, just a second, how many forgot to do it? Okay, now, just, well, that's it. Now, this is a very important point. Everybody, he says, you know, meditation, good, et cetera, et cetera. And they get into their daily lives, and it's just gone, right? You cannot remember. You cannot remember because you are caught up in the stream of things. Just to give a little analogy here, when you're meditating and you get caught up in a thought, can you remember to meditate? No, you can't. Okay, it's impossible. There's nothing you can do because, in a certain sense, you're not there at that point. The thought is having its own wonderful time, but you're not there. Any sense of presence is not there. At some point, the thought dissolves, and then you go, oh, I meant to be meditating. Now you can actually do something. So many people want to try to remember, or want to remember. They think, if I could just remember to do this. It is absolutely impossible, because when you're caught up in things, the only things that are accessible to you are in the world of thought or in the world of your story. This is why meditation practice is so very, very important. Because by practicing, you make meditation part of your life. And so it may come to you, even when you're caught up in the story. But it will not come about just through remembering, because the intellect and the conceptual mind is far too weak. Toronto, many years ago, I gave a program on, I can't remember what it was on, but it was a two-weekend program, one weekend, then a break, and then the other weekend. And at the end of the first weekend, I asked everybody to go through the rest of the week, taking a breath whenever they opened a door. So my first question on the following Saturday was, well, how are the doors? And people just went, oh. Because everybody had forgotten completely. Okay. So any other comments on what was this like? The tension between front, Kathy.
Well, just as we went to lunch, Linda and I drove together and we packed lunches. So I asked Linda, I said, hey, we should trade lunches and see what it's like to take on each other's selves.
I love it.
And what we learned was how attached we were to the selection of our lunch. Okay? And she wasn't about to give up that sandwich, I'll tell you.
Okay, that's great. I love it. Thank you very much. Anybody else? So the story rules, is that right? Okay, any other comments from anybody? Roxanne? It's okay.
So I think that if it had been an hour of silence, I would have remembered to do the exercise, but it wasn't. And so it's just choices between getting to know some other people, sharing stories about, you know, what have you, why we're here, those different things. And so it feels like a kind of zero-sum game kind of choice between that awareness and participating in what's going on around me.
How many other feels like that? It's a zero-sum game. This or that. Okay. You aren't alone in this, even though they're saying... Even though a lot of people may know up here is not a zero-sum game, in here it feels like a zero-sum game. Why? Because we don't know how to do it. You don't know how to carry on a conversation and be no one at the same time. We think we have
what
to be.
What would you talk about?
Well, actually, the number of possible topics increases exponentially, inversely proportional to the sense of self that is operating. You know, I mean, what do we have in Hollywood? Well, enough of me talking about me. Why don't you talk about me? There is only one topic of conversation. Kara.
It's not enough about me. Now that we've talked about me, let's talk about my work.
Okay.
Sorry. My mom always says that. enough about me. Let's talk about my work. I think if you can go to the place of being with a vocabulary, if you can interact with people from a place of being no one, quote unquote, then it makes you an infinitely better listener.
Definitely.
And instead of thinking of the next thing you're going to say to everyone and how that, you know, how you can interject your own ego or whatever right. into the conversation, you can actually really respond to someone.
Very definitely. We're going to go into this in the last part. Thank you. Okay. Sandy.
Well, I guess what I found out, I was actually talking to Nancy. And what I found is I took the, you know, think of yourself as no one, as to the, you know, nth extreme, that meant I didn't exist at all. And therefore, how could I be aware if I didn't exist? and which is why I couldn't get there. But what I realized after hearing that is that one of my, whatever, my patterns or my issues is always kind of being an overachiever. And so it was a very kind of enlightening moment for me that here, okay, you give me this assignment. Well, I must do it
110%.
Exactly. So I didn't even exist. And so I found that just really an enlightening moment for me.
So I just have one question.
Who am I?
Who's talking to me?
No one. I guess I'm just enjoying the sound of my own experience.
Okay. All right. Well, the next section is who am I functionally? And I'm not 100% sure of the best way to do this, so we'll try it in one or two different ways. First, this is on page 3. So I'd like you to get out your pens and paper again. And we're going to do, as you'll see, we've got 3 different takes on this. I think actually we'll start with the third. So, which is family stuff. Family conditioning is one of the deeper forms of conditioning in our lives. So, I'd just like you to take a few moments and jot down some thoughts on how you act when you feel like a child. Okay? Now, I know that all of us are mature adults. So the frequency with which we feel like a child is probably much less than it was, you know, a few years ago. But it still occurs from time to time. And there are various situations in which we can feel like a child. One, of course, is when we're visiting our parents. It kind of moves us back into that whole child thing, just like that. Of which I've had some very illuminating experiences in my own interaction there. I go like, huh? What's going on? Another is when we are dealing with authority, we will often feel like a child. Another is either when we're feeling scared or feeling very happy. In either of those cases, we can move to feeling like a child. So just with those in mind, just take a few moments and jot down a few points. And there are things like, how do I look at the world as a child when I'm feeling like a child? How do I view myself? What are the ways that I will act this doesn't have to be a lot. In all of these, one can actually go much further. What is my relationship with art and creativity when I feel like a child? What is my relationship with body, exercise, movement? How do I view parental or authority figures when I feel like a child? So just take a couple of moments with that. Okay. What I'd like you to do now is just take a moment and read over everything that you wrote. Taking it in. Of course, you may think of other things, and that's fine. But the purpose in reading it over is to get a feel for it. Okay? And then I just want us to sit and actually feel that for a few minutes. So just, okay, this is who I am when I'm feeling like a child. We're not going to do a long meditation, just a couple of minutes. Well, may be fun. Depends on your childhood, I guess. Get a sense of how you feel in your body, how you think of yourself, and how you view the world and others. Those three things. Now I'd like you to do the same thing for sibling. Sibling. And if you have no siblings? Pardon? Yeah. No, pets are close enough. I think that will do quite nicely, Kara. My mom loves my cats more than she loves me. Yeah, that'll do. Okay. So, when you're in the sibling role, you know, notice how the energy in the room just shifted. Okay? This is very different. Oh, it's going to get much better, Sandy. Don't just sit and shake your head. Right. Okay, so this entrains a whole other set of reactions. It's almost as like you're becoming another person. How do you view yourself in the sibling role? Well, there are three possibilities. I'm older than you, I'm younger than you, or I'm the same age. And so much flows just from those three. You're sitting this one out, are you, Sandy?
No, I'm listening. I'd like to sit it out, but they barred the door. So okay.
How do you feel about others, notably one's siblings? This is what Cinderella is actually about, you know. The fairy tale of Cinderella. This young girl has this wonderful world. She has a mother and father. Her father pays her wonderful attention, gets all kinds of nice things for her. Her mother takes great delight in her. And then her mother gets ill and dies. And her father remarries. And this new mother has two things with it. Stepsisters. Now, this is exactly the experience of a child when siblings come along. The mother gets pregnant, leaves, and now there's this other thing in the house, which is getting all the attention. my brother's family, his daughter is the oldest, and as my mother delicately put it, sometimes she just has to remind her younger brother of what he did to her life, and the only way she could do that is by hitting him. How you view yourself, how you view others. I didn't expect it to bring up this much. Oh, whoa.
Questionnaire.
Pardon?
Questionnaire.
Yeah, definitely. I'll have to remember that one. Okay. So just read over what you've written or haven't written, as I noticed. Okay. And just feel it. And feel who you are in this situation. Just feel it for a moment, Roxanne. Stop writing. Just feel who you are. And that's who you are in your body. It's very different. How you view yourself. How you view others. Okay, let all of that go. And move into the third family role, parent. Now, some of you may not have been parents, but almost all of us have experienced being in a parental role at some point. Yeah. You're a teacher, or you've been in a teaching situation, you've been in somewhat of a parental role. One could argue that a managerial position is somewhat of a parental role. A lot of effective managers I know just bring... who are women, just bring their child-caring skills to work, and it works very, very well. So what's your sense of yourself when you're in the parental role? I imagine it's a little different from when you were in the child role. What are your sense of your responsibilities? What do you pay attention to? What do you watch out for? What is your view of others? What's the view of your of the world and your place in the world when you're in a parental role? In the scheme of things, attention flows from parent to child. A lot of children get very screwed up when they're required to pay, to be in attention with respect to their parents. Like, really messes kids up very, very badly. So just take a few notes there. Who are you when you're in a parental role? Contrast to the child. We didn't cover this with siblings. It was too hot. What is the sense of your artistic and creative skills? What's the sense of your body? Your capabilities? And so just read that over and sit with that for a minute. Who am I in the parental role? Feel it in your body. Sense of yourself. Who do you picture or imagine or describe yourself to be? How do you view others in the world? Okay, let that go. Let's hear from some of you about your reflections. Roxanne.
Child and sibling, this story that I've been repeating for years, I couldn't even distinguish between, look, all I had was that story. I really had a very hard time even actually remembering. It's kind of like my story replaced my reality of those times, maybe.
Okay.
Very different in the parent role. I could really relate to that. That felt like me now, not because I'm a parent, but coach, teacher, manager, whatever. Yeah. That was all amazing, powerful, wonderful stuff I relate to in a way that has a physical part and an emotional part, but the sibling and child was like a train wreck of like just story, 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 and really hard to get past that.
Okay. Anybody else? I'm not even looking at you. Julia.
I was interested in the different sizes my body took on. When I was a child, I was small and weak. And when I was a sibling, I was medium-sized and very tough. And when I was a parent, I felt very vast and very soft. I don't think soft is quite the word, but...
So a very definite different perception of yourself physically.
Completely, yeah.
I can connect with what you're saying because several years ago I started studying martial arts and actually went right through and got my black belt in that particular training. But about, I think it was around green or brown belt, I can't remember, I was working out with one person who was, you know, a very senior instructor. And like his 10th level black belt, so he's way, way above me. And he's a short guy. He's maybe 5'4 or something like that. He threw a punch, and next thing I knew, he was on the mat. And I said to him, Larry, you gave me that one. He said, Ken, you know, I don't give anybody anything in this. You're a big guy. You made the move. This is the result. And I felt something shift in me right there, because I grew up, I was accelerated twice, so I was smaller and younger than everybody. And all the way through most of my adult life, I had this idea that I was smaller than everybody else, exactly what you're talking about. But it was that moment that physical self-image dropped. I went, oh, I am a big guy. Oh. So I can really relate, because we carry these things. And they're a story, as you say, Roxanne, but they're very, very powerful. Okay. Anybody else? Okay. Susan.
When we were talking about the siblings or thinking about that, I had a vision of something that I've never thought of before, although the struggle has been there, is that I came in the third child, mm-hmm. and a vision of having a table with only two legs, and I came in and balanced it, and that for most of my life, I've kind of stayed there and felt responsible to do that. And at some point, unscrewed and pulled out, but they want to bring me back.
They want to bring you
back.
Well,
that's my story. Okay. So, and that I'm fighting not to get pulled back into that, yet out here, not in it, I still feel responsible for balancing.
Yes, that's okay. That says it very, very well. So stories about our lives, we continue on. Okay. How many of you found that there were significant differences between who you feel when you're feeling like a child, who you feel like when you're in a sibling role? We noticed that one was really different. And when you're a parent, how many found there? Okay. So if we ask the question, who are you, what's the answer? Okay. Now we're going to move to the work environment. Want to do the same exercise. Okay. So let's start off when you are in a leadership role. Okay. Now, the world of leadership is the buck stops here. You don't have anything to pass anything on to. If the store isn't locked at night, that comes on to your thing, you know, because it's your store. How do you view yourself? How do you view others? What does the world look like to you?
There'll
be a certain overlap because the parental and leader there will be, but there are differences because you don't. Ideally, you don't have all your family stuff running when you're in the work environment. Well, that's this is note to self: don't have family stuff operating. I mean, and you're quite right. Because, I mean, there's a HR consultant I know, and I've used the same line myself when I'm consulting in the business world. I often say, your boss is not your father. You can actually talk to him. Okay, mother, same diff, you know. Yes, your boss is not your mother. She's not going to take care of you forever. Randy, please.
We have a sign posted in our lunchroom that says, your mother does not work here. Please clean up after yourself.
The longer one works in the same company or the same organization, the more and more family dynamics operate. Oh, particularly if it's a family business.
Even if you're not a family member.
Yeah. But the, well, yes, that's what makes family-run businesses very interesting. The euphemistic word, interesting. Yeah. Okay. So you have a sense of yourself, leadership role. So just read that over and feel that again, just as we were doing before. In how does it feel in your body? As one person says, you know you're in a leadership role if you don't sleep at night and your palms are sweaty. As Julia suggested, you may pay attention to your sense of your body when you're in a leadership role. How do you view others? How do you view yourself? What's your sense of your body? How do you view yourself? And how do you view others? And just get a sense of that. Sit for a minute with it all. Okay, let that go. Let's move into the worker role. And the world of the worker is very different. Pardon? Oh, we're going to come back to the middle. I want to do it in this order. The world of the... whereas the world of the leader is top role... is one of a lot of responsibility and accountability. The world of the worker is, you've got your work to do, but things happen to you. You know, they shut plants down. That has a small effect on you. Doesn't necessarily have an effect on the leaders, but it does have an effect on you. You have a certain notion of responsibility. But it's very, very different, I suspect, from the leader's responsibility, sense of responsibility. How do you feel in your body as a worker? That varies a lot from person to person. How do you view others? What's your sense of power in this role? How many of you know someone whose personality seemed to change when they were promoted or moved to another job? It's quite frequent, actually. They seem to become a different person. So read that over take it in, and just sit with that for a minute or two. Again, the same three things: your sense of yourself, your body as a worker, your sense of yourself, your role in the organization and whatever you're doing, and your sense of others. Let that go. Then I go to the third row. Middles. You know, like middle management. Now, the middle is defined as anybody who has somebody above them and somebody below them. And you have to take into account what the person above you is doing, and you have to figure out what to do with the people below you. And oftentimes what you're getting from above and what you're getting from below, they don't exactly match. You know what the real situation is, but your boss is telling you to do something which may work or may not work. So what's it feel like in that role? Now, there are many, many places in life where we end up in this situation. In large corporate structures, the division presidents are actually all middles, because they have to, they're managing their corporation, and rather at the head of it they have the corporate above them, and they behave much more like middles than they do than like leaders. Sometimes they behave like workers or bottoms too. Interestingly enough, teachers, Buddhist teachers like myself, were classic middles. We have one above us, the sense of tradition and the ideal of awakening, and below us, students, and we're mediating between the two. So, when you're in this middle role, what's it like? This is somewhat like the sibling role. Interesting parallels there. You notice that? It's interesting, because every one of these exercises is a very different energy in the room. As soon as we switch, like, everything changes. A lot more discomfort around this one. People were happy being leaders, they were happy being workers, but here they're going, "Arr." So, sense of your body, sense of yourself, in terms of responsibilities and what you try to do, etc., in that role. Sense of others. Do you see others as cooperative or uncooperative? Helpful, unhelpful? Threatening or servile? Everybody got a few notes here? So just read it over and sit with this one for a moment. Just for a minute or two. Sensing your body, in this middle role? Being in touch with your sense of self. And how you view others in the world. Just sit with the whole thing. Let go. We have a fourth role in the work situation, which I've called, customer. Customer isn't exactly the right word. Maybe some of you can think of a better word. But it is someone who is outside the particular corporation but needs to interact with it. So, obviously, a customer. You know, you want to buy something from them. But you could also be a vendor. That is, you're going to sell something to them. You could also be a government agency. You're trying to regulate them. Not that that happens much anymore, but that's another story. You could be a charity trying to get a donation. Okay, so this is a very different role. When you're in the customer role, what is your sense of self? Now, for me, and this is a mea culpa, you do not want to know me when I'm on a tech support call. I become a different person. I'll be flat out about that. Every now and then I have a really good experience, but most of the time... Okay. So whether you're a vendor or a customer or an agency of some kind, you could be the environment, you know, like a citizen interacting with the corporation, not for any buying or selling anything, but because there's an impact on the environment, so you want to do something. What is it like interacting with that system? What is your experience there? What's your sense of yourself in that role? What is your sense of others? Keep grounding in your body because there's a lot of information there. This makes sense to everybody? Not too abstract? Nice experience and then a very bad experience with Hewlett-Packard, but the nice one outweighs it. I had this printer which I hadn't used for a very long time, like several months. I came back from vacation and I turned it on and it wouldn't turn on. I knew my warranty was running out, so a month before the warranty actually ran out, I called them up. I said, I can't turn my printer on. And they said, okay, fine. And went through a whole thing, and they said, well, I said, is it still under warranty? And they looked it up and said, well, actually it is. So they sent me a replacement printer, and it works. But there was no holes, you know, no hassle, and it just went straight through. I won't tell you about the second experience, but that was the first one. I like that one. But I have to say that my main response to that was surprise.
I noticed my penmanship on page 3 is a lot worse than my penmanship on page 2.
Okay. Well, we will be going into deeper depths, so maybe it will become illegible by the time we finish. No, actually before.
Oh, before.
Okay. So just read over what you've written. Who are you when you're interacting with an organization, an institution? You know, you could be a student applying for admission. Okay, what's your experience? What's your sense of self? Who are you in your body? How do you view others? Just sit with the whole thing for a minute. I'm sorry if you're getting a stomach ache. Let's hear from some of you about your reflections on this. Nancy.
Well, I felt pretty relaxed in my body as a worker. I think my experience as a worker has always been really good with quite a lot of freedom. But I was a middle manager for many years, and I realized actually in doing this exercise that the tensions that I felt in that middle management job were patterns that I brought to it from my family. And they were mostly, the hardest thing for me was that because I wanted to be open and communicative with people that I was supervising, they would bring their problems into the office and they would leave feeling pretty good, and I would be sitting there with their problems. And and even with a fair amount of therapy, that never went away. Yes. And so
But you're a qualitatively different person in the worker role versus the...
Yes, okay. Yes.
All right.
And a much more relaxed person.
Okay, anybody else? Randy?
Unlike what seemed like the rest of the room from the comments made earlier, I actually like the middle position the best.
A lot of people do. You're not the only one.
I'm comfortable in all three. I've been in all three. And at the bottom, there's little responsibility and there's little challenge. At the top, there's a lot of responsibility and a lot of challenge. And in the middle, there's the problem solver and the mediator. Mm-hmm. And that's a role that I enjoy and I do well in. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why.
But you notice that you become three different people in those.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What about the customer?
That I found harder because there's so much variety. When I'm inside a company interacting with an external vendor to buy something, I'm a very different person than I am as a customer going into another. So I had a hard time with that because it really encompasses all three of the roles.
Okay. Well, yes, but it's also different from all three. So
we maybe
should break it up. When you're trying to sell something, you're one person. When you're trying to buy something, you're another
person. You're different, yeah. And also, I'm a different person as an individual customer, say, walking into a shoe store, than I am as a manager representing my company and buying a major contract.
Yeah. Okay. And the point of this is actually to bring out how many different people we are. Roxanne, did you have something?
Yeah. What struck me as I saw the similarities, the customer role was actually the one that most related to my family roles, the sibling side, because in the other three levels of work roles, although there are a range of different views of myself and experiences, I always turn it into something constructive and find a way to be powerful and creative in that situation. But in the customer role, I was thinking about, like, Time Warner and, the customer experiences where I'm intolerant, demanding, feel like I've got no power to make it better. And it was those kind of negative customer experiences that more reminded me of the emotions that come up in the family side.
Jill, we haven't heard from you.
It was interesting since I work in a family business and I'm not a part of the family, but the dynamics in terms of, you know, being at the bottom doing the work, it's like, it's okay, you know, I just want to please everybody. And the middle management is like, okay, who do I make mad, or, you know, who do I make happy, who do I upset, how do I, you know, come to a compromise? And the top is just kind of a relief because, oh, you know, I can decide and I can just make the decision, which is unusual from my family pattern. So that's how they all kind of tied in.
Okay. Anybody else? Francis, microphone right here.
Well, like you said, it's four different people, but I think the roles that you see yourself, or at least I saw, and were all based on my past experience. And having worked at a very large entertainment company in Los Angeles, where, which I won't mention, but most people know what it's like to work there, and where I was a VP of marketing, but I was within a division, within a division, within like the top, it became, and I had like 25 people reporting to me. The word I think of is exhausting, because I cannot please everybody in trying to get a balance between management's expectations, which are like off the charts, and just, you know, they want a 20% increase in sales.
Every year.
It's like, you know, it just doesn't happen that way. And but then having a team of 25 people who I feel are working like a dog, and when it comes around to like bonus time, they tell me there's no bonuses, but yes, we can give each person a 0.8% pay rise. And I felt like, I realized I was taking on a parental responsibility, because I felt like I couldn't look after my children. And and I'm the eldest of four, so that's part of the reason why. And so I don't know, I found all of these not as, I think I'm trying the reverse of what I was in my family, actually, except where I'm the parental role. But I had little control in my family. Mm-hmm. And I realized that in work, I try and get that control in my professional life, because it's a lot easier to control than my personal life and relationships. So at least that's what I found.
Yes, so you notice we didn't put relationships on this list.
And I find as a customer, I realized that, and I never realized this myself, how incredibly demanding I am of my vendors and suppliers. Mm-hmm. But that's because I feel like when I've been the vendor, I have provided the best service. But there are situations where someone has come back to me and said, you know, that was a great meeting. You totally took the vendor apart. And I'm like, I was like, I did? I said, all I did was ask them a few questions. But in their mind, I've taken the vendor apart. And honestly, I was like, that's not my style, but apparently it is. And I never recognized it. But I'm incredibly demanding, and I realize I'm very intolerant of mistakes from my vendors. And perhaps I need to ease up on them a bit.
Well, maybe. So, again, here are four different roles in the workplace, and they're kind of the, with the qualifications we put in earlier, the archetypal four roles. Tops, middles, bottoms, customers. And we essentially are a different person in each of these roles. Just to illustrate this, an aspect of this which you may find interesting, one of the things I wanted you to focus on was the sense of other. Well, in the world of workers, you find that workers come together. So this is what gives, and when you have bad management, of course, you get unions coming together, because there's a sense of they're doing it to us again. Whereas in the middle role, it's exactly the opposite. Because they each have their own areas where they're mediating between top and bottom, they actually never see each other. And there's very, very little communication that takes place within middle managers. There's a workshop that I do which simulates this, and in every one of them, I did down at one of the museums here, and the people who are in the middle management role, before the simulation started, looked at each other. We're going to talk with each other, right? But once the simulation started, they literally never said a word to each other. It's the nature of the space. It's isolating. And then you go to the top role, and this says a lot about what happens after revolutions. Okay. They fight. They're fighting for turf, because everybody wants to get more control. So if you look at a successful revolution, people start off in a revolution in the bottom row. And if the revolution's successful, they end up as the top. And what happens when the revolution is successful? You find all the top people who are now leaders of the government fighting with each other over who's going to do what. Happens every time. And it's as if these people just change their personalities. Okay. Now we go into the next thing, which is the top one. This is based on the six realms, of course. When you find yourself in opposition, who are you?
You mean like child manager?
No, just now in your life. When you find yourself encountering opposition. Yes, ornery teacher. Who do you become when you are experience opposition? Are you a fighter? Are you an acquiescer? Do you try to negotiate? Pay very close attention to your body here, because it will tell you where you first go. Okay, so make a few notes about who you are in opposition. Again, to refer to Peanuts, do you take a page from Lucy? The best defense is good offense, and the best offense is total annihilation of the opposition.
By the way, his biography is fascinating.
Is it? Oh, okay. Now, in thinking of yourself in terms of opposition, it may bring up some uncomfortable feelings. I understand that. This is the hell realm, where everything is opposition. How does your perception of the other change? Who do they become for you? There is an account recently of how Bill Clinton was meeting with a bunch of superdelegates, I think, in Northern California. And at the end of the meeting, somebody made reference to Bill Richardson's endorsement of Obama. And he just let loose in this tirade. I think he lost about 15 superdelegates for Hillary right then and there. Just like that. Oops, yes. Okay, so just sit with that for a minute. Who am I in opposition? How do I feel in my body? How do I view myself? How do I view others? There's explosion is one possibility. Cold, calculating is another. I don't want to be here is another. This isn't happening. Just sit with all of that. Okay, let that go. And now, who are you when you need something? Who do you become when you need something? I have a student who's pretty good in terms of her practice. But she has a tendency to tell me what she needs from me as a teacher. I need you to be like this and like this. And she's got this very long, very, very precise list. And the difference between when she's being present and when she's being needy is really quite remarkable. So what's your sense of your body when you need something? Julia, Susan, could you pass the microphone? Okay, Karis.
In these questions, I'm finding myself going to both sides of the pattern.
When people need something from you?
One, I'm being either a tyrant or a victim, or a... Do you see what I'm saying? So you're saying, when you're saying, who am I when I'm in
okay.
hell realm?
You find yourself flipping on each of these. Okay. Just take note of that. So it sounds like you have two distinct ways of reacting. And so either... For instance, with the hell realm, you either give up or you fight like hell. Okay? And needy, you either say, no, I don't need that, or you become desperate. Something like that? Okay, so just just take note of that. That's how it is. And please bring up that point in the fourth section, because I have an interesting... way of looking at that, which maybe you'll find helpful, possibly. So it's a very different sense from opposition, isn't it? Not necessarily. Okay.
I say not necessarily because if there's something you need and there's opposition to you getting that, you can...
Then you're suddenly in hell.
Right, but...
Mm-hmm. But before there's opposition, when
there's
you just need...
There's a lot of fear.
There you go. So there's what's your sense in your body? What's your sense of self? What's your sense of the world when you need something? There you are. It's not there, right? I can't get it. So you've written a few notes there. So let's just sit with that for a moment. I need something. As Kara said, there's some fear there. Maybe it's the first fear. I'm not going to get it. How does that change how you see things, how you experience things? Let that go. And now we look at the next one, which can be characterized by the phrase, I'm just trying to survive. Just pay the mortgage. How many of you have seen Thank You for Smoking? Yeah, it's a great movie. Well, there's several wonderful things in it. But one of the things I really like is you have the person who's playing this lobbyist for the tobacco, who, when asked, how can you do this? I'm just trying to pay the mortgage by the reporter. Of course, when the reporter turns around and completely trashes him, how can you do this? I'm just trying to pay the mortgage. This is pure animal realm, just doing whatever you need to do to survive. Okay, so when you're in that kind of survival mode in your life, what is your sense of yourself? What's your sense of your body? What's the sense of the world and others? We get right into Maslow's hierarchy of needs here. You know, like the caribou. It's getting hot, we should go up. It's getting cold, we should go down. Caribou. No. That's not about the air conditioner. About elk and caribou. It's hot. We should go down. It's cold. No, it's hot. We should go up. It's cold. Go down. Very simple. Like a python. Not hungry. Sleep. Hungry. Eat. That describes the life of a snake.
Thanks. But that goes back to my question about awareness.
Yes. What's is it one thing?
No, but we're given this gift of self-awareness so that we can actually work towards enlightenment or waking up. But we are not afforded the opportunity to just simply live in harmony with our surroundings and adjust ourselves accordingly.
Well, from one perspective, it's very fortunate that we don't live in harmony for our surroundings, because if we did, then we would have no urge for enlightenment.
Absolutely. On the other hand...
Yeah, arguably it's the only motivator in the end. Okay, so survival. You got a sense of yourselves as survivors? Okay, so just sit with that for a moment. How does that feel? Doing something blindly, because it's the only way you know how to live. Okay. Now, who are you when you want something? And there's a difference between want and need. When you need something, it's because you feel it is essential to your survival. When you want something, it's because you want to enjoy it in some way. So there's a very definite difference in quality. And it brings out a very different personality in us.
Does that include wanting to achieve a goal?
That's actually more... do that, but that's going to be more in the next one, comparison. But there are some ways. I mean, the personal goals. Goals that don't involve recognition from others. I know we're going through a long list here, but the point is, are you getting the point? There are a lot of different people in there. It's worse than that. It's a bureaucracy.
Did you ever watch that show Herman's Head? It was on in the 90s, early 90s. It's pre-Simpsons. And it was a sitcom on Fox where this guy, they had his four ego components.
Oh.
And he would go through all of these situations and you would see them in his head, and it was just this big, it looked like Pee-wee's Playhouse. And the four of them lived there, and one of them was the bookworm, and he was very rigid and smart, sort of fatherly. And then you had the frat boy, And then you had the motherly, like, feminine side. And then you had, like, the childish one. And so, you know, as he was, like, courting women or trying to get a promotion, you
know, four would come out.
They would, you know, show him, and then they would flash to his head and, like, what was going on and like that. And I've never seen it on DVD available, but it's actually a really, like, it's a really cool show.
And it's right on target.
Yeah, totally. Yeah,
okay, thanks. Herman's Heads. Okay. Sandy.
It's interesting what I'm finding about me. I'm assuming you're getting at, you know, who am I if I'm all these different people? But as I go through all the different things, they all seem to end up with the same core of who I am.
And this core would be?
Basically, I think my sense of what I've tried to overcome from my childhood.
Okay.
I mean, that's how it seems to manifest itself on each level. The qualities that I find myself feeling proud of or, mm-hmm. you know, want to, you know, cultivate are those that I've worked hard.
Okay.
And the ones that show up are the ones that haven't been totally resolved from what came from my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And I find they're pretty much consistent throughout every realm. I don't know if that is unusual or not, or if it really matters if it's unusual or not, but that was just an observation.
Well, you're quite right in that there's certain behaviors and ways that dominate. And for that reason, people say, well, this is my core. Okay. But there are two things we should note about that. One is that core actually isn't always in operation. There are circumstances we encounter where it isn't present at all. When you're enjoying yourself, does that struggle to overcome your childhood operate?
Mm-hmm.
When you are enjoying yourself.
Even, and that's it, even when I'm at my absolute worst, the good points I've cultivated stay. When I'm at my absolute worst, the good points that I've cultivated stay intact, even when the other ones come through. And when I'm thoroughly enjoying myself, there's that small part of that unresolved issue that always feels present. So they're always present in greater or lesser degrees. But they all seem to be present at some point.
Okay. But you see they're constantly changing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's so that from the point of view perspective that I'm working with means that none of them are your core. Because they're constantly changing.
Okay.
Roxanne.
So as I'm listening to Sandy and I'm wondering what's on, you know, everybody's page in the room, and I'm thinking.
But everybody hand in their notes to Roxanne at the end of this piece.
More because I'm thinking there are probably a lot of the same words, and so, you know, that whole range of different views of ourselves, if all of us cycle through an mm-hmm. ever-changing set of all that same stuff, it's, you know, feels less tied to our own story, and that, like, unique, the power of it being, it's because my mom said blah, you know, that all of that's just the human experience, so it doesn't have to
right.
be so tied to.
And I do this because my mother said blah is also a story. You know, maybe it's because your mother said blah. Maybe it's something else.
That's what life feels like.
Yeah. Okay. So, want. You got clear about that one? I'm just going to move through the next one. Next one's comparison. That's the polite word. It leads to competitiveness. And again, this is very, very different from some of the other ones. How do you behave when you're feel you are being compared or you are comparing yourself with others. My family, it took me a little while to realize this. I connect with something that you said, Francis, when you said you take the, people say you take the vendors apart. People always said, whenever we play a game with you, Ken, you get so serious. And eventually I figured out that it was because in our family, we played games for blood. That was what fun was. But, you know, we was all out when he played games. So he got really serious about that and had fun the rest of the time. So this is all about comparison. It was like, who's going to be best? So who are you when you are comparing or you feel you are being compared? We don't want to go there. Are you right? Okay. And then the last one. Who are you when you feel special? That can be especially good or especially bad, your choice, or both. But there's another whole set of behaviors that come up when you feel special. You're in a privileged position. How much effort goes into preserving that privileged position, etc. We had this wonderful doctrine which held sway for many, many centuries, that people who are in privileged positions were there because of the will of God. It was called the divine right of kings. It served to maintain power structures for several centuries, but eventually it was exposed as a story. Okay, so I've taken you through all of these things, and I don't think anybody here is going to be is in the dark about why. This is who we are from a functional point of view. And who we are from a functional point of view, even though there may be some persistent traits, really changes quite significantly from situation to situation. Yet how often do we say, oh, I'm a different person in this situation? No, we actually go through life always feeling that we are the same person, even though we may be exhibiting totally different behaviors, have totally different worldviews, have a totally different sense of our body in those different situations. So we're very enamored of the idea that there is this self which doesn't change. But whether we, if we review very quickly, and I just want to set this up before we take our break, whether we view it from a functional point of view in which we have, a conventional point of view in which we have these stories and we can pick and choose what story we tell, whether we view it from an ultimate point of view in which we can't actually find anything which corresponds to this is who I am, or whether we view it from a functional point of view, that is, there are all of these different ways we behave, different personalities that come out according to situation. The question, who am I, is either none of these or all of these, but you don't get anything in between. Okay? So that's the point of this. Go and enjoy your multiple selves for about 10 minutes. We'll come back and do the last bit.
You have just heard a talk by Ken MacLeod, author of Wake Up to Your Life and director of Unfettered Mind, a California nonprofit corporation. This podcast and many others can be found on both iTunes and on the Unfettered Mind website at www.unfetteredmind.org. This podcast is free and has been made available through generous donations from our listeners. We would appreciate any assistance you can offer. Your tax-deductible donations may be made through the Unfettered Mind website, unfetteredmind.org, where you will find translations, articles, information about Buddhism, and other programs given by Ken MacLeod. All rights in this podcast, given by Ken MacLeod, are owned by Unfettered Mind. Unfettered Mind hereby grants you, the listener, the non-exclusive license to listen to and distribute this podcast freely, but only without charge and only if each copy contains all the original contents and these proprietary notices. You may not charge any fee of any kind for making a copy of this podcast available in any form. You may not extract portions of this podcast except for commentary purposes and only if you give proper attribution and this proprietary notice. You may not include this podcast, or any portion thereof, with any other podcasts, talks, information, or data for which any amount is charged. Title, ownership rights, and intellectual property rights in and to this podcast shall remain in Unfettered Mind. This podcast and all elements within it are protected by the copyright laws of the United States and international copyright treaties.